now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Hopefully this story could be one in which comes to you later in your dreams. but is a beautiful story. It's quite a simple story. It's finding the butter in every bowl of milk. It's a story that has been handed down for generations. Sometimes it shows up in different versions, but the one version that I'm going to share with you today is a powerful story that was told to me the very first time I visited India. I was just, probably more of a tourist than a spiritual seeker at that time, even though I was very much drawn to the spirituality and the pulse of India, so to speak. And I was visiting with the Sikhs, that is capital S-I-K-H, and visiting with one particular Sikh spiritual leader, Baba Ram Singh, in Karnal, India, the northwestern part of India. And during my, I think it was a four-day, five-day stay with him, at one point he shared with me this story about where do we look to find God? In other words, where is the most important place to look for God? The story goes like this. So, there once lived a king who was quite rich. He was a very, very wealthy king. And this king used to pray a lot. Every day, he used to pray. In the morning, at meal times, and even at night, he used to pray. But one day, a thought came into his mind, and he said, I pray to God. I always think about God, but where is God? Where does God live? So, he sent out a message to all the people of the land that if anybody can tell me where God is, I will give you 100 gold coins. Well, of course, the news got out that this rich king was going to offer 100 gold coins to anybody who could tell him where God was. And everybody wanted to try and tell him. They would tell him, I can tell you where God is. God's in the mountains. God's in the sky. God's in the heavens. God's in the sea. God is in faraway countries. But this wasn't quite what he was looking for. Then one day, an old man came to see the king. And he was considered a very wise old man. Everybody knew him as just a very quiet, very calm and humble person. And he said to the king, "Sir, I know where God is." The wealthy king asked, "Really? Please tell me, where is God?" Now this wise man said, "Okay, I just need you to bring me a bowl of milk." Well, the wealthy king didn't understand how that would help, but it seemed easy enough. And after the milk arrived, this wise man said to the king, "Now, I want you to put your hand in the bowl of milk." So the king, hesitantly at first, but he eventually put his hand in the milk. Then the wise man asked him, "Dear king, what's in the milk?" The king paused for a second and he said, "There's nothing in the milk. It's just a bowl of milk." So the wise man asked him again, "Are you sure, dear king, there is just milk in there?" "No," said the rich king, "there is nothing in the milk. It is just a bowl of milk." So the wise man said to him, "Okay, your majesty, I want you to stir the milk with your hand." So the king stirred the milk, and he stirred it, and he stirred it, and he stirred it. He stirred it for such a long time that he had to take a rest. And after he rested, he started to stir the milk again. He stirred it, and stirred it, and stirred it, and in time, from the same bowl of milk, there was cream. And as he kept stirring, then there was butter. These things came from the milk. The rich king looked at this wise man and he said, I don't understand. What's the point you're trying to make? I asked you to tell me where God is, and you just got a bowl of milk and made me stir. And yes, okay, I see the cream eventually came out, and then it turned into butter. So, where is God? The wise man said, Sir, God isn't necessarily far away. God can be found inside of you. And what we have to do sometimes is to churn ourselves. Sometimes we have to churn our minds and churn our heart and churn our feelings, churn our soul. And sometimes we just got to call on God's name, or we chant God's name, and that chanting is like churning. It's like the churning of the milk. Slowly, within time, we'll see that God is inside of us. Just like the butter is inside the milk, God is inside of us. After hearing this, the rich king fell to his knees, and he bowed to the wise man. You know, little did I realize that after hearing this story for the first time, just how important it is to understand that the presence of God or the divine can be seen in everyone, especially ourselves, in everyday life. If you were with me last week, I was talking about the fourth trip in India that I went, and how I was looking for God in, let's say, the places. And interestingly enough, God showed up in the very simplest, ordinary acts of people, which then, of course, that turned out to be extraordinary moments. And it's almost as if God slowed me down and said, look, you really want to see me? Pay attention to the simple acts of ordinary people, and I will be there. See, just like being able to understand and see butter in every bowl of milk, we too can come to that place of understanding or awakening whereby we're able to see the soul of every person. Now, I realize, you know, on the surface, we just might find this teaching difficult because whenever we look at ourselves and we look at others, all we see is just so much physical pain, so much emotional wounds, many, many psychological sufferings, many expressions of anger and violence or lust or jealousy and brokenness. It just seems to go on and on and on. But can we also see what's underneath these expressions of pain and suffering? Namely, the potential for God's presence to transform these wounds into a life-giving means of creating the healing we truly want to see in this world. Can we see the potential for the milk to be transformed into butter? Now, let's take this desire to see the potential of God a little bit deeper and ask ourselves this one question. How many times do I struggle with seeing God in this world? How many times do I struggle to see God in myself? Because perhaps I'm unwilling to shift my focus. Perhaps I'm too busy to quiet myself to listen to God's still, small voice. Or, tell you what, let's take this one step further. Let's take it even deeper and ask ourselves this question. How many times do I wrongly assume that in order to see God, I must first make God conform to my vision, my philosophy, my worldview, my prayer? That if God wants a relationship with me, then it's going to have to be on my terms. Have you understood that? Have you? And this is simply not the way to start seeing ourselves as soul. We're going to keep looking at that bowl of milk and wondering, I don't get it. What am I looking at? We will be forever looking at that milk. Well, if you are among the early 70s crowd out there in Radio Land, there was a popular song you might remember written long ago during the Jesus movement of the early 70s. Called Day by Day. I'm sure you're going to start singing along. But the lines were, Day by day, day by day, oh dear Lord, three things I pray. To see thee more clearly, to love thee more dearly, and to follow thee more nearly day by day. Think about these words for a moment. To see thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, follow thee more nearly day by day. We sit with these words long enough, and if we're really honest with ourselves, we just have to come to the conclusion that we're not going to obtain these things simply by rubbing Aladdin's lamp and hoping to get three wishes. I mean, the only thing that we're going to get out of rubbing a lamp is a shiny lamp. But how do we see God more clearly? And really, how do we love God more dearly? How do we follow God more nearly each day? Let me propose this idea. Perhaps before we ask the question, how do we do these things, maybe a better question would be for us to first understand from where inside of us, and perhaps more importantly, where inside our soul do these questions, these desires come? See thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, follow thee more nearly, day by day. Perhaps the desire to see and to love and to follow God actually comes from a deep place in us, perhaps so deep that words simply cannot express. Perhaps this is actually the very cry of the soul. And as we start to heal from our psychological and emotional and physical and spiritual wounds, we begin to look at ourselves and others differently. We begin to relate to ourselves and others differently. Because we're in a better place. We're in a better space. And this is a very, very good beginning. However, when we are able to see what we are truly made of, that is, we are light, we are soul, we begin to understand the true meaning of looking for the butter in every bowl of milk. It may not be there at first glance, but as we develop our relationship with God and the divine, we heal from our woundedness. And as we develop our relationship with God and heal from our woundedness, this will certainly show up in our relationship with one another. We listen to the cry of the soul, and we heal. The irony in all of this. When we are truly able to see ourselves as souls, and ultimately, when we are able to realize and live as souls, and we begin to see other people as souls, don't be surprised if you're no longer willing to accept relating to people as anything less than them being souls. This is what I mean by that. You know, we no longer focus on the externals that have often caused so much pain and division and suffering in the history of humanity. The other day, I was surfing the internet, doing show prep, and I was just curious about isms. Okay, I-S, anas, isms. And I just typed in, how many isms is there in our language? And I was surprised to find that there are over 230 isms out there that have found their way into our vocabulary and our descriptions and behaviors. And when we realize ourselves as souls, isms fall away. They cease to exist within the context of the soul. Because when we see ourselves as a soul and we truly, truly understand that, embrace that, and start to live that out, and we truly see the souls in the lives of others, and we truly live that out, there is no more room for sexism. There is no more room for racism. There is no more room for ageism. There's no more room for egoism. Isms simply do not have a voice in the matters of the soul. Well, if you like me, you're a fan of comedy here and there, and perhaps you remember the famous line in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where Ferris is talking to the camera while he's in the shower, which I have to say is an interesting scene right there, and he says, "Not that I condone fascism, or any ism for that matter. Isms, in my opinion, are not good. The person should not believe in an ism. He should believe in himself." I quote John Lennon, "I don't believe in Beatles, I just believe in me." Good point. After all, he was the walrus. I could be the walrus, but I'd still have to bum rides off people. But, in all seriousness, people, there are no more isms of this nature simply because they just cannot hold up to the standard that we are souls. We are all children of light. But ironically, when a belief becomes an ism, it generally becomes part of one's identity, how you see yourself, how you categorize yourself, how you see others, and how you categorize them. And yet, seeing the soul in every person is just like seeing the butter in every bowl of milk, and it shifts our relationships. Back in the early 90s, there was also a shift going on in the field of psychology from the understanding of, prior to that time, people were, or I should say, the psychologists and psychiatrists and mental health professionals were trained to very much find out just what's wrong with people. Just a diagnosis. And once we have a diagnosis, once we know what's wrong with people, we can help people then discover what they need to do. How can they heal? Whether it be through medication or talk therapy or some other form of behavioral therapy, whatever they need. But this shift occurred because it went from that kind of perspective to then helping people discover what's right with them. Or in other words, helping them discover their character strengths. And this is called positive psychology. It came out of the vein of the cognitive therapy group. And positive psychology encouraged people and mental health professionals to not so much focus on what's wrong with people, but instead encourage them to identify with their positive gifts, their graces, their skills, their character traits that they already possess. And by doing so, and when a person really just embraces, or I should say, reclaims their character traits, they are empowered toward a more solution-focused approach to their problems. No longer, I have yet to hear anybody say, "Woe is me," after they discover the character traits and the positive things that they have going for them. And another tool I use to help people discover their character strengths actually comes from two guys from University of Penn, Peterson and Seligman, who have identified 24 categories of character strengths. And they developed a values in action survey where you can actually go and take the test and discover your character traits. And some of these categories include appreciation of beauty, bravery, creativity, spirituality, curiosity with life, fairness, forgiveness, gratitude, authenticity, etc., etc., etc. You see, as people begin to rediscover and explore the implications of their positive character traits, they are empowered. Perhaps for the very first time in their lives, to name and start to reclaim what gives their lives meaning and purpose. They go from merely surviving in this world to thriving in life. And anyone can access their website. I'll give it to you right now. It's viacharacter.org. Or maybe www.viacharacter.org. All one word, that's in the back part. It is a lengthy test, you'll have to take your time, but it is certainly well worth it. Have some fun with that. Discover what your character traits are and poke around their website. You do have to register, but they promise not to spam you with any advertisements or anything like that. And if they do, let me know, and I will gladly talk to them about that. But for the most part, it is so much fun just sitting with somebody who is discovering their heritage and rediscovering and reclaiming those things that they had long neglected or thought that they never existed. And yet, this awareness of these character traits is only the beginning. But if we recognize positive character traits in us, chances are that, as I shared a few weeks ago, our ancestors possessed those same character traits as well. You see, trauma is not the only thing that may have been passed down to us. We've also received positive character strengths, such as maybe strong work ethics and resiliency, just to name a few. Either way, to truly live our lives to our greatest potential is also to realize who we are as souls, as well as that our gifts and graces and skills and character strengths are for the benefit of others. I remember one time I was counseling a 17-year-old boy who had just gone through some pretty horrific trauma himself. At just such a young age, and it was just, he was just collapsing under the weight of the pain that he was trying to bear up under. And as we were working, as he was healing from his trauma, I gave him homework one week to go on the values in action, character, the DIAcharacter.org site, and take the survey, and then come back, and then we would discuss it. And one of his top three, I think it was, character traits, was his love of music, which he later confessed to me that just something that, because of the trauma, he described it as the music died with me. And it was very sad the way he described it. And so he used his character traits as a means to have a conversation with your ancestors, have a conversation with your loved ones who have gone on before you, go back to your family tree, as it were, and see who else might have had a love of music. Well, he came back the next week, and he said that he found that his great-grandmother had a love of music. She was actually a singer. And he started to appreciate his musical gifts. He started to use music as a means of reclaiming his voice and to heal from the trauma that stifled him. And I'm happy to report, folks, that now he has gone on to college. He is not only a music major, but he's also doing speech pathology. And he wants to combine the two disciplines and go into the field to be a speech pathologist to help other people find their voices through music. There are many people who may never realize who they are as souls, let alone being unable to embrace such strengths in themselves. Perhaps they were never allowed to realize their potentials, or they hid their strengths out of fear, rejection, or shame. Regardless, positive character traits are in all of us. We just have to find them. We just have to reclaim them. Well, I would love to hear your heart on these matters. So after the break, I'll be taking your calls. Again, the number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I'm Dr. James Hunt, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, Finding the Courage to Reclaim That Which Has Always Been in You. I'll be back to talk with you in 1 minute. earlier in the show, we were talking about the story of finding the butter in every bowl of milk and how this story is a metaphor for having awareness and insight to see the transformative properties in milk. That is, if we're able to churn the milk long enough, the milk will have transformed into butter. Now, in the same vein, there's also that transformative potential, as it were, for us to see ourselves and each other as souls. That what we see on the surface or the external is really not who we are. And yet, so many times, focusing on the external has often been the cause or justification for humanity to commit horrific crimes against one another. Because I think the thinking or the belief is that because a person appears to have certain physical features, that they are considered inferiority or less than, based on someone else's limitations or feelings of inferiority about themselves. Many people take on this belief because they don't have the strength to fight that. And so they embrace it. And they reinforce the emotional, the psychological, the physical, and the spiritual wounds that have been inflicted on them. And it just becomes lower after lower after lower. However, when people become aware of themselves as an eternal soul, they are so empowered by this awakening that they are no longer willing to go back into society's box. They are no longer willing to accept society's labels that they will never amount to anything because of where they came from, or the color of their skin, or what gender you are, or how old or how young you are, or a person's mental or physical illness, or the fact that they survived an accident and now are maimed, or any other pitiful label that seeks to keep people in this compartmentalized definition. I mean, sorry folks, your soul cannot be kept in a box. Your body, yeah, someday, but never the soul. Well, as I said, I talked a couple of weeks ago that when we begin listening to the cries of our ancestors and becoming more aware of our own soul's voice, it is inevitable that as we begin to listen to the ancestors, we're going to become more aware of our soul's voice and vice versa. As our soul consciousness matures, we realize that we share an eternal connectedness with all of creation that exceeds our present time and space. And although this initial awakening is often met with excitement and joy, I guarantee you, you're going to often be faced with this recurring question, such as, okay, now what? What do I do with this? What's expected of me? How do I live out this awareness each day? These are all good questions, ones in which I guarantee you we will spend the rest of our lives answering every day. In fact, the continual awareness of our soul consciousness and connection enables significant emotional, psychological, and spiritual shifts in us. In fact, we no longer can see things the way they used to be, because our perceptions have undergone a wonderful transformation as our inner awakening challenges us to live more authentic lives. But this inner transformation compels us to not only rethink and reevaluate our former ways, but also it compels us to transcend and go beyond our perceived limitations. Go ahead and just for a moment, ask yourself this question. How differently would I live my life if I fully realized myself as a soul? How differently would we live our lives if we fully realized ourselves as souls? answer is that our lives would look a lot different than what they appear to be at the present moment. I also suspect that we would be so empowered to treat ourselves and all relationships with the fullest extent of kindness, the fullest extent of love, the fullest extent of patience, the fullest extent of compassion and grace that I guarantee you the world would then definitely sit up and take notice. So when I was a student in my graduate school days, I was in the time when I was first exposed to Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you remember his model, it's in the shape of a triangle, and he used it as a means of understanding human nature and striving to achieve personal goals. And it's a model of understanding the self that follows this logic that our lives go through the stages of attaining personal needs, needs such as food or clothing or shelter, security, intimacy with others, goals, life meaning, purpose, etc. Ironically, today, many people believe that once they attain this self-actualization, according to Maslow, or discovering their life's purpose and motivation and meaning, then they will have found the life satisfaction that has so long eluded them. However, many are often met with the harsh reminder that attaining one's dreams and ambitions and goals does not necessarily guarantee happiness, let alone finding this inner peace. Moreover, despite their accomplishments, people still sense that something is missing from their lives. And if this is so, why then do so many people feel empty when they have so much? I get this question in counseling at least once or twice a week. Say, Doc, on the surface, I should be happy. I have everything I want. I worked hard for everything. How come I am so miserable? How come I am struggling with this depression? How come I'm so anxious? How come I am so filled with anger and rage and pain and bitterness? I thought that if I could just work my butt off, keep my head down and do what I'm supposed to do, then I would be rewarded with everything that my little heart desires. Now, after several hours sitting with them, just holding the space, so to speak, listening to their story, and actually helping them grieve lost expectation, I get out Maslow's hierarchy of needs model, and we walk through it. And they tell their story in pointing out, yes, I have this, yes, I have goals, yes, I have security, yes, I have that special person in my life, and so on, and so on, and so on. Point after looking at this model, and they say, I don't get it. What's the problem? In fact, many times, people express feelings of disappointment with Maslow's hierarchy, and I have to gently correct them and say, well, it's more like a misperception that it's a flawed model. Nothing wrong with Maslow's hierarchy model. It is what it is. But perhaps, you know, we need to understand that this model is limited. I mean, self-actualization can only carry us so far. But self-realization awakens the soul. Attaining true happiness, joy, and peace in our lives comes not from the accumulation of things or degrees or accomplishments, but rather these come from the grace of God's presence that can only touch our soul. Indeed, there is a greater depth of contentment, forgiveness, love, joy, peace, etc. that awakens in us when we fully realize ourselves as God's grace. And it is through God's grace that we are able to recognize our soul's connection to God and throw off that cloak of illusion. Still, the limitation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs model doesn't mean that self-actualization is a worthless pursuit. On the contrary, we all need to have our basic physical needs met. We all need to have a sense of personal security. We all need to have meaningful relationships. And we all need to achieve attainable goals in our lives. And yet we also have to understand these earthly pursuits are always going to point us towards a higher awakening of self-realization of who we truly are. In other words, it always points to the fact that we also need to take hold of something better. Another time I was in India, I heard another Sikh story, again, S-I-K-H, that involved going and looking at the ocean. And the storyteller said that, explained to me that when we were able to look at the ocean, or this works also with a creek or a lake or a river, that we're all droplets of water returning to the river or the ocean. And as droplets of water, we are really no different from one another, albeit the externals. So why do we have externals? Why on earth are we here as embodied souls? Well, some would say that we are embodied soul because of karma, something that our soul still needs to work out in terms of the lessons that we need to learn and the healing that needs to take place in us, so that we can further learn whatever deeper lessons there are for us. Well, indeed, there are lessons for us to learn, and quite often other people often function like a mirror that's being held up to us for us to see the reflection of our thoughts, the reflection of our words, the reflection of our behaviors. Many, many times in counseling therapy, people are struggling with, I know that there is something better out there for me, I just don't know how to go get it. I don't even know what better looks like. Because they have been so used to carrying around burden after burden after burden of the wind that they have simply gotten used to. That they just can't even imagine life better. So it's very difficult to talk about these issues at times with people who are just faced with the here and now, simply just wanting to survive, and survival is a day-to-day just struggle. And yet it still can be possible. It's possible because, just like looking for the butter in every bowl of milk, looking for their potential, seeing the potential in them, that seeing ourselves as souls and realizing that we are souls is not just for a select few. It's for everybody to realize. It's for everybody to come into this awareness. Doesn't mean that we first have to get our act together in order to see it. But it's a process. It's a willingness. It's a cry from the very depth of the soul to say, I'm in misery here. I am suffering. I cannot take anymore. I am in pain. I am in misery. And yet my soul cries out. Guarantee you, that's a cry that's going to be heard. The cry is going to be understood. It's a cry that's going to be met by others who know where that cry is coming from, who see and hear truly what the person is actually saying, how the person is actually crying, what do they need, how do they need it, where person to understand that they are loved with an everlasting love can be so foreign to a person who has been told that they never will amount to anything at all in this life. Telling a person that they are loved simply because they take a breath just may not resonate with somebody who can't imagine anything else because they've never been shown anything else. However, if we're able to show that kind of love, that heart-to-heart, that soul-to-soul connection, they will take notice of that. Because it's spoken, and it's a need that's met at a much, much deeper level. Yes, empowering others to fulfill Maslow's hierarchies of needs of simply having a meal, having something to drink, a roof over your head, clothing, security, shelter, the basics, as Maslow put it. Very good thing. In fact, we can't let anybody just simply go through life without. So we have the means to help and we don't. The actions do speak louder than words. Because it's the cry of the soul that perhaps words cannot express. But actions, behaviors that come from that expression of love and a depth and seeing potential in every person to not only get back on their feet, to not only see the potential of them healing from their wounds, but also to see the potential that, yes, they then too can, as they go up the Maslow's hierarchy of needs ladder, so to speak, to realize that it's not a matter of reaching the top. It's a matter of what you do when you find yourself at the top. You come back down and you help other people as they are seeking to meet their needs, as they are coming to the realization that they are souls. But hopefully when that person along their journey is able to then go back and help others, who are then able to go back and help others. The plain and simple truth is that as we minister to people in the physical sense, we certainly touch their souls in a spiritual sense. It is an awakening that melts even the most hardened heart. I've seen it with my own eyes. I didn't believe it, but I saw it. And it just confirmed in me that there is no greater force on the face of the earth than love. And trust me, love is a force. We often get it confused and say, well, love is mushy, love is romance, love is this, love is that. But no, love is a force. Love has the power to transform lives. That's a force. That's a force that just keeps the momentum going. And once the momentum is going, you're never going to be able to stop it. Society, all down through the ages, all down through history, have tried to silence the soul, and it's just, nope, not going to work. Not going to happen. You just can't stop the power of love, the force of love. You cannot stop transformation. Transformation is ongoing. Transformation is powerful. Transformation is contagious. One person gets a taste of that transformation and that realization that they are souls, and it just goes from there. Because what they do from that point on, what they say from that point on, how they see themselves and how they see others from that point on, it's just going to so radically change relationships. That's the power of the soul. That's the power of love. That's the power of this realization that we are eternal souls. We are love, we are light, we are soul. I'll share with you one last story. It seems like tonight's been time to tell stories, but stories often have a way of impacting, or as I say, put an exclamation point on what we've been talking about here. But this is a story that actually comes from Anthony Bonello. He was a Catholic priest who just wrote wonderful short stories and poems and so forth. Just had a tremendous, tremendous impact during his time. And the story, again, when I heard it way back in graduate school, has always stayed with me. And it really sums up, again, just the beauty and the impact of reaching out for something better has on us and on those around us. The story is entitled, The Diamond. When the wise monk one day reached the outskirts of the village and settled under a tree for the night, a villager came running up to him and said, "The stone, the stone, give me that precious stone." "What stone?" the monk asked. "Well, last night God told me in a dream that if I went out to the outskirts of the village at dusk, a monk would give me a stone that would make me rich forever." The monk rummaged around in his sack and pulling out a stone, he said, "Well, God probably meant this one. I found it in the forest yesterday. Here, it's yours if you want it." And the man gazed at the stone in wonder. His eyes just got huge. For he was holding the largest diamond in the world. It was the size of the man's head. And so he goes running on back to the village. "I'm rich, I'm rich, I'm rich." But that night, all he did was toss and turn in bed. He tossed and he turned and he tossed, but he did not get any sleep. At daybreak, he goes back into the forest and he finds this monk. And he goes, "Sir, sir, dear, dear sir, here, take this diamond back, because I want you to give me the wealth that makes it possible for you to give this stone away." See, many times we believe that God can be captured in the external, that if we just polish up the outside, then God can be found in the aesthetics of people and places and things. And it's true. God can be found in the people, places, and things. However, the danger of this far-sightedness is that when we are so focused on the external, we can often lose sight of what's more important. We cannot see the soul of another person, let alone the butter inside of every bowl of milk. And that is my heart's cry for each and every one of us here today. But when we find that desire, when we find that awareness of that just awakening of who we are as souls, it's going to transform us like we have never imagined. And we are no longer going to be content with somebody else's definition of what they think people ought to be, or how they are categorized, and so forth. It's just, I speak that from my own life. I see it in the lives of many, many people. And letting go of all those things in order to take hold of something better. In the depths of your being, there is also an inner peace. It is a peace that is experienced when the truth of who you really are is unveiled. I am Dr. James Houck, and it has certainly been my pleasure to be with you here today. Join me next week as we take a look at self-inflicted wounds and how often they affect relationships. Please, enjoy the rest of the day, be safe, and as always, may God hold you in the palm of God's hand. Take care. Bye-bye.
an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauk. It's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.